Thank you for being here, members and visitors alike. Most of you are aware that the Hammondses are a little underrepresented. Taylor and Tracy took off at 4:45 this morning on their way to Lakeland to pick up Kylie, so hopefully we'll all be here on Wednesday, Lord willing. When I grew up to be a man, will I dig the same things that turned me on as a kid? Will I look back and say I wish I hadn't done what I did? Will I joke around and still dig those sounds when I grow up to be a man? Brian Wilson and the other Beach Boys asked those questions and other related ones back a little bit before my day. And it's a song like a lot of rock and roll songs are. It's about childhood and about adulthood and about the transition from one to the other. And basically the question, do I have to give up the things that I really love about being a child when I become a grown-up? Adulthood is inevitable. We understand that. But hopefully it doesn't mean we quit being kids. That's kind of the theme of the song, seems like to me. And I had that song, which is not necessarily one of my favorites either, so that's a little annoying. But buzzing around my head a good bit this week as I was putting this lesson together. And I was thinking about growing up in the faith and growing up in the world and what it really means to be an adult. I have no problem with children being children. I love it when children are being children. I think that's wonderful. In fact, if I see a 12-year-old that acts like a 25-year-old, I get a little freaked out. I don't like that. 12-year-olds should act like 12-year-olds. 4-year-olds should act like 4-year-olds. It's a good thing. Childhood is all about finding out who you are, finding out what kind of person you're going to be. It's about pushing your limits. It's about experimentation. It's about finding what works. It's about making mistakes and hopefully learning from them and going on to making other mistakes. Under normal circumstances, it would be a dangerous way to live your life, but it's okay because you're doing it under the auspices of your parents. And your parents are there to help you, to pick you up when you fall down, to guide you through life, to help you learn from the mistakes that you make along the way, and hopefully keep you from making the really, really big mistakes. So that when the time comes and you become a grown-up, you'll be in position to do these kind of things on your own. The assumption always is that you're going to be a grown-up one day. And that shelter that you've enjoyed, that you took advantage of, and rightfully so when you were a child, is not going to be there anymore. And for whatever it may be worth, one of my biggest issues with the current culture is that we seem to be deliberately developing a society where children are, in the first place, sheltered by their parents from the consequences of their mistakes, and consequently kept, essentially, from growing up, kept from learning what it is to make a mistake and to deal with consequences of it. And then beyond that, when the child escapes the home and goes off on his own, that same attitude is carried out in many ways by government. We continue to shelter our young and not quite as young people from the mistakes that they have. And essentially, they never really grow up. They never really become adults. What I want to do for a few minutes here this morning is talk about becoming a man or a woman. It's not about transgenderism, like it was suggested. It's not the sermon at all. But what it's going to be like. And especially I'm talking to younger people here. But if you are a parent of a younger person or a prospective parent of a younger person, it's okay for you to listen along too. If you're in your 20s or maybe even in your 30s, there may be some points of application here for you as well. Because it's vitally important that we as human beings grow up, that we develop into what God would have us to be. And especially we're going to have some spiritual applications to these kind of things. Most fundamentally, I want to talk about taking responsibility. When I grow up to be a man, I will take responsibility. You don't have to take responsibility when you're a child. Your parents are responsible for that. They'll take responsibility. If you get yourself in a big mess, then your parents bear the brunt of that. If you throw a rock and, you know, when you're 10 years old and you break your neighbor's window, your parents will pay for that, or hopefully they'll pay for it. If you're my neighbor, you better pay for it. Because ultimately we understand that parents are responsible for their children. But when you become an adult, you accept and you want responsibility for your own life. Your own mistakes are your own. The consequences for your mistakes are your own. Own your weaknesses, I suggest you here. And try your best to eliminate them. If you're not very good at X, then get better at X. Especially if this is a God characteristic. If you're not any good at knitting and you don't want to get any better at knitting, that's your business. I don't think that's any big deal one way or the other. But if you're not very good at hospitality, for instance, or at service, or at Bible study, or prayer, if you have moral laxity in your life, that's a problem. And you can blame your parents. Your parents may have something to do with that. You can certainly blame society. Society may have something to do with that. But part of being a grown-up is accepting I am not what I ought to be, and that's on me. I need to take personal responsibility for that. David is a great example of this in a couple of ways. One, he made a lot of mistakes. And two, he seems determined to learn from his mistakes. And that's a good thing. That's what we need to be doing. Various psalms touch on this, but the classic is probably Psalm 51. In Psalm 51, the first few verses there, David writes, "Be gracious to me, O God, according to your loving kindness, according to the greatness of your compassion. Blot out my transgressions. Wash me thoroughly from my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin. For I know my transgressions, and my sin is ever before me. Against you, you only, I have sinned and done what is evil in your sight, so that you are justified when you speak and blameless when you judge. Behold, I was brought forth in iniquity, and in sin my mother conceived me." And he goes on to talk about his life that is a consequence in many ways of his sinful choices. And I deeply regret that verse 5 is taken out of context to try to do exactly the opposite of what Psalm 51 is trying to say. A lot of people will go to Psalm 51:5 and try to say it's not really David's fault that he's sinning because he was born that way, just like we're all born that way. We have some kind of inherited nature that we get from Adam that's a perversion of Bible concepts here. David is not trying to say here that he was in sin as soon as he was born. He's saying that he is a sinner because he himself made mistakes. And that, isn't that what he's saying the first few verses? Watch me thoroughly from my, not Adam's iniquity, not Adam's sin, not Adam's transgressions. Adam's is mine. And David acknowledges that. I made mistakes. And I take verse 5 to be basically an exaggerated way of saying I got into sin as fast as I could. I wasted no time. And didn't we all? Are we all in that kind of position? We don't need to feel better about ourselves in our sinful state. We need to feel worse. Not for the sake of being depressed, but so that we will acknowledge that this is a situation of our own making and one that we have a remedy for in Jesus Christ. How wonderful it is that we can go to our Heavenly Father because we have this relationship with our Savior and ask Him and trust that He is going to forgive us of our sins. I don't know if you've arranged the murder of a friend of yours or stolen his wife or fathered a child illegitimately by that wife this last week. I hope and pray that's not the case. But if it is the case, as it was with David, you can be forgiven even of that. As heinous as we may think that our own transgressions are, God is capable of forgiving us when we will acknowledge our own culpability and be humble enough to acknowledge who we are and who we are not. Own our own mistakes and try to atone for them. You make a mess, you clean up your mess. You try to teach the children that when they are not really capable of cleaning up messes. And thankfully, not really capable of making gigantic messes unless you leave them for hours at a time on their own. And I don't want to get into your parenting strategies here. That's your business. But generally speaking, we don't permit the children to get into situations where they can burn the house down and things like that. If they spill milk, that's a problem. And we help them realize they made a mistake. They may have done it deliberately. They may have not done it deliberately. Either way, there is a problem, and they have a responsibility, and they can clean this up for themselves. And we can help them learn how to make up for their mistakes, so that when they get bigger and they get more opportunities to make bigger and grander and more life-altering mistakes, they are also inclined to fix those mistakes because they've taken responsibility for them. The choices that we make in our lives have consequences. They are meaningful. In 1 Corinthians chapter 15, we oftentimes quote verse 33 out of the context a little bit and talk about the friends that our kids are supposed to be associating with or not associating with, really more to the point. Do not be deceived, he says. Bad company corrupts good morals in the New American Standard Bible. But the overall context here primarily is talking about false teachers, about the decisions that you've made in your doctrine, the decisions that you've made in your relationship with Jesus. And you've decided to associate with things that are bad for you. And because of that, going back to chapter 11, many are weak and sickly, and some sleep. There are serious spiritual consequences. You can go back to chapter 5 and see what one man is doing with his life and what everybody else is doing with him. And it's an atrocity. What are we going to do about this? Well, as much as we can, we're going to fix it. And it starts, again, by realizing how bad our situation is and how much it's our fault. Going on to verse number 34, he says, "Become sober-minded as you ought and stop sinning. For some have no knowledge of God. I speak this to your shame." You ought to be embarrassed about this. You know better than this. Now, the language we would use for an 11-year-old and the language you'd use for a 21-year-old and the language you'd use for a 31-year-old are probably a little bit different and probably ought to be. But in every situation, we realize that it's incumbent upon the individual to fix things that they have done wrong, to realize that they've made a mess of their life and they have opportunity and they have obligation to fix it as much as they possibly can. Own your own future and try to turn it toward God. It's disheartening when I hear people who are caught up in circumstances that are largely out of their control and partially not of their own making, perhaps. And they claim to basically have lost their life. You know, it's all over for me. You know, I'm kind of doomed to this subpar existence. Never going to get a job, never going to get a family, never going to get whatever it is that they think they're... You know, I'll never be popular, I'll never be good, I'll never be smart, or you know, whatever it happens to be. And I don't doubt that all of us have barriers in front of us of one nature or another, in one area or another. And I don't doubt that some of them you're probably going to want to overcome and be incapable of doing so. But realize also that there is a very real sense, a very significant sense, in which your future is under your control. And now, I'm not suggesting that God does not have ultimate control, because he does. And I'm not suggesting that you have control over things beyond you, because you don't. But if you want to be a Christian, for instance, go be a Christian. If you want to be joyful, then go be joyful. If you want to be knowledgeable, then go be knowledgeable. You may not be able to accomplish whatever carnal task you set your mind to, whatever task in the flesh that you may set your mind to, but you will be able to accomplish your task in your efforts toward God. And that's the wonderful thing about turning your future toward God. You know that you're going to succeed because God is going to help you succeed. And by succeed, I don't mean becoming an elder in the church. I don't mean raising godly children. I mean drawing closer and closer to Jesus Christ, which may or may not involve those other things. But if you want to draw closer to God, if you want to go to heaven, I assure you are capable of doing that. It has nothing to do with your circumstances. has to do with your willingness to accept responsibility. Don't assume anything. Don't assume the good things. Don't assume the bad things. Take control of your day, such as it is. In Ecclesiastes chapter 6, verse number 12. For who knows what is good for man during his lifetime, during the few years of his futile life? He will spend them like a shadow, for who can tell a man what will be after him under the sun? You don't know what your day is going to be like. You don't know what your future is going to be like, how much of it there is. Will it have good things? Will it have bad things? Will things improve? Will things deteriorate? We don't know. But regardless of what happens or does not happen, part of being a grown-up, part of being an adult, is realizing that I am driving this bus. And I can drive it toward God, or I can drive it away from God. It's up to me about this. And if I see some kind of barrier on my road to God, I will find my way past it. I'll find my way around it. Or maybe God will take me over it. I don't know exactly how it's going to work out, but I'm not going to get dissuaded from this path that I've chosen for myself, the path that God has chosen for me. I will take responsibility for being where God wants me to be. Make a plan for heaven. Determine that whatever happens in your life, you're going to go to heaven when you die. And I realize that may seem kind of simplistic, and maybe it is, but it's real. Paul writes in Colossians chapter 2, verse number 18 and 19, in the context here of Christians who are being subjected to false doctrine and obligations that were not imposed on them by Jesus Christ, and guilt feelings for not imposing on themselves. He says, "Let no one keep defrauding you of your prize by delighting in self-abasement and the worship of angels, taking his stand on visions he has seen, inflated without cause by his fleshly mind, and do not hold fast and not holding fast to the head, from which the entire body, being supplied and held together by the joints and ligaments, grows with a growth which is from God." He says similar things in Ephesians also. The idea here is that there are going to be people coming around and telling you that you're incapable of being a Christian. You're incapable of serving God effectively. You're because of your background, because of your skin color, because of whatever it happens to be. You're not cut out for this. And you can answer back, "Yes, I am. God can make me cut out for this. And I can strive with every day that God gives me to draw closer and closer to my head, Jesus Christ." And if you are connected to the head, firmly connected, you will find that the strength that he supplies to the overall body that we read about in Ephesians chapter 4 is also supplied to you individually. That you can become stronger and more adept if you will hold fast to him as fast as as hard as you possibly can. But that's your choice. You can, if you like, live your life in abandon, just taking it each day as it comes, serving God when you feel like it, not necessarily serving God when you don't feel like it. Like a kid. You can do that if you want to. But if you're growing up in Jesus, that means accepting that you are in charge of getting yourself to heaven and determining that more than anything else, that's exactly what you're going to do in your life. Which kind of leads us to the second point. I will work hard. This is what kids dread about adulthood probably more than anything else. They don't dread paying bills because they don't understand bills. They don't dread being fired because they don't understand being fired. They understand work, though. They understand it enough to avoid it. They understand the difference between giving your best and giving your least. And hopefully, we as parents have instilled in them some appreciation for the difference between the two and our disapproval of giving less than your best. Because whether a child of 8 or 10 or 12 does an adequate job of washing the dishes or taking out the trash or cleaning his room is really of no big-term consequence. If I'm interfering with your parenting, I apologize. That's not what we don't teach the children to clean the room so the room will be clean. We teach the children how to clean the room because they need to understand about work. They understand They need to understand about responsibility, about applying themselves, finishing a job. I tried to have one of these moments with Taylor a couple of months ago, and she's not here, so I'll tell a story on her. I'm trying to be poetic, and I'm not sure exactly it worked. It usually doesn't, but we were talking about household chores or something, and I asked her, when do you quit cutting the grass? When do you know you're done? And she didn't know what I was talking about, which is understandable, because you don't understand what I'm talking about either. I said, you quit cutting the grass when the grass doesn't need to be cut. You do the job until the job is finished, and then you quit doing the job, unless you have a stroke or you run out of daylight or something like that. Generally speaking, you work until the job is done, and then you can quit. Now, it's a lot easier to mail it in. It's a lot easier to just kind of, you know, and declare yourself done. We, as adults, have learned that if you do that, you're going to make a mess of your life, that you may not be able to fully clean up. It's much better for us to value excellence, for us to really appreciate a job well done. The things of excellence is one of the things that Paul mentions in Philippians chapter 4 and verse 8 that we're supposed to focus on. If there is any excellence, he says, if there is anything worthy of praise, think about these things. I trust that you as parents, when you have little ones in your charge and you give them some menial task to accomplish and they do it, that you praise them for that. That's great. You did good. They need to appreciate that. You did something good and I honor that. In our minds, it's very, very little. In their minds, it's everything. And they grow to understand that doing a good job is why you do the job. Not just to get mom and dad off your back, or even to please other people, so that you will learn what it is to work, and to work well. Satisfaction, as we read from Ecclesiastes chapter 9 and verse 7 and following a little bit earlier this morning. Satisfaction comes from doing your best. And I try very hard with my children to instill a proper satisfaction in their heart when they do a job well. And some manner of dissatisfaction when they don't. We don't have to be mean about it necessarily. But realize doing a job well makes all the difference in the world. Now, discipline is going to come involved with regard to this. Discipline that comes from others. Discipline ultimately that comes from ourselves. Realize that extra effort, pushing ourselves, going beyond our comfort zone is necessary and a good thing. I doubt that you're ever going to talk to an Olympic gold medalist who says, you know, in retrospect, I probably spent too much time training. I probably didn't eat enough donuts. I think if I'd eaten another donut a week, I still would have won the gold medal. I wish I had to do it over again. I'd probably do it that way. I don't think you're going to hear him say that. They're going to say, I was striving for excellence, and it meant me doing things that I hated, and it meant me avoiding doing things that I love. And I did it that way. And at the moment, I wasn't very happy about it. But I had a big picture in mind. I had a coach who cared enough about me and who was guiding me along the right path that I trusted in. And here we are. Look at this marvelous result that we have at the end of the story. Hebrews chapter 12 is a passage that I've referred to a lot with regard to discipline and training and parenting. The responsibility that we have to accept discipline and to instill it in those who are under our charge. The way that Paul phrases it, or whoever the author is, in Hebrews chapter 12 is a little bit scary in verse number 4. You have not yet resisted to the point of shedding blood in your striving against sin. And I connect this to the imagery that we see elsewhere of boxing and in this context of physical training, that you push yourself and you think that you have done everything that you can do. And you know, I had a little league coach that told me I was supposed to give 110%, and you know, I was always kind of a math geek when I was growing up. I said, there's no such thing as 110%. You know, I knew what he meant. And you know what he meant. You know, it's there's what you are prepared to give, and then there's what you're capable of giving. And sometimes you don't realize what you're capable of. And you need to push yourself a little bit more. You think that you're working really, really, and I'm just going to have a field day with my kids here since they're not here, I guess. You know, you put your kids to work when they're, you know, whatever, 8, 10, 12 years old, and they're out there weeding the yard or whatever, and they think they're working. They really do. They think they're giving it their all, and you are looking at them, and you know good and well they are not working hard, right? It's not their fault. We don't blame them for that. Hopefully, anyway. It's not their fault. So we discipline them. Train them. You've not yet, and I'm not suggesting here that they weeded until their hands bled. They didn't do that. Nor that you should tell your children to weed that way either. You've not resisted the point of shedding blood yet. You think that you are working. You think you're giving everything you have, and you're not. And you're going to be asked to give more than you're giving right now. Are you prepared for that? Are you willing to accept that form of discipline? And realize where it's coming from. Not from a tyrannical, mean-spirited father who just takes joy in bossing you around, but someone who knows what you're capable of and is determined to get it out of you. You've forgotten the exhortation which is addressed to you as sons, verse 5 reads. My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor faint when you're approved by him. For those whom the Lord loves, he disciplines, and he scourges every son whom he receives. Sometimes not giving your best brings upon you a penalty. You suffer because of this. You have to run an extra lap or, you know, whatever it happens to be. And it's not because you're being hated. It's because you're being loved. Because more is being expected out of you than you're expecting out of yourself. And I'm probably scaring the daylights out of the little kids that are listening here, and I apologize for that. But I'm sure similar things have been told to you by your parents too. You may not necessarily need to give an enormous amount of your life when you're 8 years old or 10 years old or 12 years old. But there will come a time when you will not only need to give more than you're giving, but you will directly pay a penalty if you don't. So much better for us if we learn how to do it when we are younger. We learn how to value discipline. And closely related to that, the idea of self-denial. There are certain things that we want that we can't have. And I think there's more to God's commandments than simply telling us to avoid certain things so that he can know that we're willing to say no. I think there's more to it than that. I think that he's working his good in us. He's not keeping us from fornicating just because he wants to see if we can do it, for instance. Or keeping us off of drugs because he just wants to see if we can do it. He's trying to make the best out of us. But there are going to be moments when what you want is not in harmony with what God wants. And we need to find a way to discipline ourselves. You know, I don't know how many of you are on a diet necessarily. You know, if you're 8 years old and you want a cookie and you have access to the cookies, you probably eat the cookie, right? That's kind of the way it works. If you're a grown up and you're trying to lose weight and there's a cookie and you have access to the cookie, you have a dilemma on your hands. Now what are you going to do? Well, you can eat the cookie if you want to. You have that power. You're a grown-up. Or you can not. Are you going to be willing to deny yourself? Now, I'm not saying anybody's going to go to hell over a cookie. But I will suggest to you here that there are things in this world that are evil. And those evil things, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eye, the pride of life, are designed to appeal to you. And if you indulge in them, and if you continue to do so, they will kill you. They are poison to the soul. You can be forgiven of your sin. You can be healed of your sin. There's no question about that. But if you persist in evil, you can find yourself in a position where you've fallen from grace and are not anymore in a saved condition. Galatians chapter 5, verse 4 tells us that. And James tells us, chapter 5, verse 19 and 20, that if anyone is persisting in sin and you intervene in that person's life, you can save that soul from death, he says, and cover a multitude of sins. That soul's going to die. This soul's going to die if this is the one that's in sin. We have to take responsibility for this and work at avoiding evil things. But we also need to avoid good things sometimes. Too much good can also kill. Sometimes things that are not necessarily bad things, that in their place are good things, can be turned to evil. They can become poisonous as well. Paul writes in 1 Corinthians chapter 9 about the conflict that he has, the struggle. And again, athletic terminology. Paul's a big sports fan, apparently. And he talks about those who run the race, all run, but only one receives the prize. He says, run in such a way that you may win. And verse 25, everyone who competes in the games exercises self-control in all things. They then do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. Therefore, I run in such a way as not without aim. I box in such a way as not beating the air, but I discipline my body and make it my slave so that after I have preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified. Paul takes responsibility for himself. There are certain things that I cannot have, that I will not allow myself to have. In the context of 1 Corinthians 9, these are good things, noble things. Availing himself of his liberties to be paid under certain circumstances, to be married. But he says, I can be a better Christian in this other place by denying myself these good things. You may find yourself in a position where you have the opportunity to indulge in something that there's not necessarily book, chapter, and verse to prove that it's wrong, but you know that by engaging in this behavior, you're becoming a weaker Christian. That's a time for self-discipline. And mom and dad aren't going to be there necessarily to help you make that decision. You need to be able to make it yourself. That's part of growing up too. I'll be mindful of weaker ones also. A few words about this. Part of growing up is appreciating your relationship with other people. Paul tells the Ephesians in chapter 4 that part of the reason that you stop stealing and work with your hands, what is good, is that you be able to help those who do not have things. See, we complete the cycle. Instead of stealing from somebody else what they have earned, we go out and earn something so that we can give to somebody who really does have a need. There are weaker ones. Women, for instance. No offense, ladies. This is the words of the Apostle Peter here in 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 7. That husbands are supposed to live with their wives in an understanding way as with a weaker vessel. Not weaker spiritually. I'm not sure even weaker physically is the point there. But realize that you have an opportunity to build somebody up or crush somebody. And the easy thing may be to crush. Now, I found out very early on, thankfully not the hard way. As I got married, you know, I what, 26 years old, I thought I knew stuff. You come to realize, young men, especially if you're not married or recently married, please pay attention. Because you don't know this as well as you think you do. I come to realize that my wife was different than I was. In a lot of ways. Not bad ways necessarily, but just different. And part of it is this communication kind of thing. And it occurred to me, it was kind of a bolt of lightning revelation at some point. It occurred to me that I could talk to my wife for 15 seconds. It wouldn't take any more than that. In 15 seconds, I could ruin my wife's life forever. I could say things that would destroy her, that would perhaps serve some kind of short-term benefit, make me feel good about myself, make me feel superior, make me feel like the boss or whatever, but say things that I could never get back, that I could apologize for the next 50 years, and it would not make any difference. That's the kind of power that most husbands have in their relationship. And some husbands get drunk on it. They enjoy the feeling of domination. They enjoy the feeling of, I'm in control. I'm the boss. And they crush the spirit of their wife. And I urge you not to do that. Realize what a tremendous blessing you have. And how hugely responsible you are in this. If you're not married, maybe I'm scaring you to death. Maybe you should be scared to death. I don't know. It is a daunting task to be the head of a house, to be a husband. Realize that we have power, and we need to use that power in a responsible and loving way. Children are weaker in a physical way and other ways as well. And we have opportunities to abuse them. And you can define the word abuse any way you want, I suppose, in the modern day. Or you can treat them like Jesus did. In Jesus' case, in Matthew chapter 18 and in other places as well, Jesus shows a particular fondness for children and reaches out to them and encourages us to do so as well. Whoever then humbles himself as this child, he says in verse 4, he is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven, and whoever receives one such child in my name receives me. But whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to stumble, it would be better for him to have a heavy millstone hanging around his neck and be drowned in the depths of the sea. I realize he's talking about spiritual children here. But I also realize it's given in the context of physical children. The verses before, he calls a child to himself in verse number 2, sets him before him. You need to become like this child, he says. Children are dependent. Children are needy. Children trust. They leave themselves vulnerable, especially to authority figures. And you have a responsibility, especially as parents and grandparents, to take charge, to take care in your charge of such ones. And be sure that the hand that you offer to them is lifting them up and not crushing them. Afflicted ones. Again, maybe a little bit out of context. In James chapter 2, verse 14 and 15, the one who says, you know, depart, be warmed and filled, and doesn't actually help anybody. He's not done anything. In the context, of course, he's talking about faith and works. But the image is powerful in its own right. The one who knows in his heart to do good and does not do it, him to sin, James goes on to say in chapter 4, verse 17. We have opportunity to minister to those who are in trouble. And Jesus says, the one who does so, in Matthew chapter 25, does so unto me. Whoever saw the one who was hungry or thirsty or naked or afflicted, in prison, sick, you minister to him, you're showing what kind of person you are. You're ministering to me in the process. It's our responsibility to reach out to such ones. And to, for lack of a better term, sensitive people. Those ones who get their feelings hurt. Those ones who take everything personally, take everything very hard. Let me offer you a bit of unsolicited advice here. If you have some kind of conflict with somebody, and it goes poorly, and your response to this conflict is, that person can't take a joke, I assure you, you've made a mistake. You've done something wrong in a situation like that. Getting somebody else to toughen up, getting somebody else to be better at taking a joke or not taking things so serious, that's not a cure for your own character problems. I'm aware that it is awkward and sometimes it seems impossible for us to govern our lives based on how we are going to be interpreted by other people. I get that. It is maddening. The things that people take personally these days. But I am an adult. And this person, I will say they're acting like a child, right? They're being childish. Yes, they're being childish. I can't afford to be childish. I'm going to be a grown-up. And if that means encouraging them to be strong instead of telling them just to, you know, get tough. My job is not to toughen them up. My job is to be softer. As Paul says in Colossians chapter 4, verse 6, our speech is supposed to be seasoned with salt so that we know how to respond to each person. It's aggravating when I hear Christians defending their speech patterns. And this is the way I talk, and a lot of people take it the wrong way, and you know that's their problem. No, it's not their problem. It's your problem. Be a grown-up about this. Take responsibility for the things that you're doing to other people. If they choose not to grow up, that's their problem. And they'll give account for that one of these days. But in the meantime, can we find it in ourselves to be big? to act like adults. That's not necessarily the most happy look at adulthood. That wasn't my purpose here. There are a lot of really great things about growing up. Trust me. But the kids have that figured out already. The part about spending your own money and buying your own clothes and going to whatever movie you want to, they've figured that out on their own. Trust me. They don't need any help with that. What they need to understand is the tough part of being a grown-up, which doesn't make you hopefully want to not be a grown-up, but rather prepare you for what is coming to you in your life. Now, a lot of this has application to actual growing up in the flesh, but especially I want to urge you to grow up in the Spirit and to accept responsibility for who you are and who you are becoming and who you want to be as a Christian. That begins, of course, when you're baptized in water for remission of sins. That continues every day of your life as you grow closer and closer to Jesus Christ. This is your responsibility. This is your life. It's not always going to be easy. It's not always going to be comfortable. But you can do this. And you have a house full of people and a Savior in heaven who are eager to help you in whatever way we possibly can along this journey. It begins, again, with baptism. It begins by giving your life to Jesus Christ and saying, I want to be like Jesus. You can't start being like Jesus until you determine that you're going to be like Jesus. And that happens in baptism. So why don't you make that commitment in your life? Why don't you turn your life over to Jesus Christ this very morning? Don't wait till evening. Do it this morning. Accept him as your Savior. Put him on in baptism. Do whatever it takes the rest of your life to grow up in all aspects unto him. If in some way you have fallen short and you need help from us, you need help from your Father, you need forgiveness for something that's gone wrong, don't hesitate to ask for that as well. Whatever we can do to help you along the road, please respond while we stand and sing at this time to encourage you.